Blog Talk Radio.
This is not a drill. This is not a drill. General quarters. General quarters. All hands on your battle station.
Midrash, where the Navy MilBlog community's top bloggers discuss the latest developments, long-term trends, and the way forward for the Navy Marine Corps team and all things maritime.
And welcome everybody to episode 13 of Midrash. This week's topic will be the United States Marine Corps and forcible entry. I'm your host, Sal, from the blog Commander Salamander, and my co-host today will be the ever-genial Eagle One of Eaglespeak. So kick back, enjoy yourself, and thank you for joining us. Whether you are here with us live, in the archives on Blog Talk Radio, or downloading the podcast from iTunes. For those of you listening live, make sure and scroll down to the bottom of the show page, so you can find it, the Blog Talk Radio show page, and you'll see the chat room. Come on and join the usual suspects. We already have a good gaggle going. If you have some questions, Eagle One will be right and heard in the chat room, so you can feed them right into them there, and we'll roll them into the show. Our guests today are Dakota Woods, and then we'll follow up with Mark Stanovich. Our first guest will be Dakota L. Woods. Dakota is a senior fellow at the Center for Strategic and Budgetary Analysis. He's currently involved in studying operational challenges of irregular warfare, complex contingencies under high technology conditions, and the proliferation of nuclear environments. Before his retirement from the Marine Corps in 2005, then Lieutenant Colonel Woods served in a variety of operational staff assignments, including the Marine Corps Military Assistant to the Director of the Office of Net Assessment, Mr. Andrew Marshall, and providing defense issue analysis support for the Commandant of the Marine Corps on Alignment of Strategic Initiatives Group. Operationally, Lieutenant Colonel Woods was recognized for logistical planning and execution contributions to several operations, including Operations Enduring Freedom and Iraqi Freedom. Immediately following his retirement, he provided support for the Department of Homeland Security as the Operations Officer for the National Biosurveillance Integration System. He received his BS from the Naval Academy, and he also holds an MA from the Naval War College, where he graduated with distinction, in addition to meritorious recognition from the Marine Corps School of Advanced Warfighting. Dakota, welcome to Midraps.
Glad to be here. Thanks for having me on.
It's an honor. We've been talking for weeks that, you know, we need to have a show about the Marine Corps, because we've been really focused on what the Navy is and what it does. So the great opportunity to have you and Mark later on to take what has been, in our sense, either a strategic discussion or a Navy discussion to wedge the Marine Corps in. If you could, for a second, like I said when I introduced you, you're presently at the Center for Strategic and Budgetary Assessments. If you could, for a minute, for our listeners, tell us what you do there and what is the broader mission of that organization.
Well, it's a non-profit, not-for-profit public policy institute that focuses on defense-related issues. Most of the sponsors of the work that we do are Department of Defense entities, and we then, on behalf of the sponsor, look at issues of national security import that are of interest to that particular sponsor. And those challenges can be capability competitions. You know, I have a capability, my opponent has a capability. How are you doing in that environment? What changes may have implications for the Defense Department? It could be various strategic competitors. You know, a specific look at a certain country or a class of countries. And what they bring to the table, or it could be just changes in the operational or tactical, I guess, environments and how technology or certain aspects of those environments are changing over time. And then again, what are the implications for the U.S., but specifically focused on the Defense Department and the military services in particular. So the kind of work we do is supposed to help people think better about whatever that particular issue might be, and then make whatever investments would be appropriate. And that could be, you know, a type of equipment or training or changes in organizational dynamics so that U.S. forces are better postured to win in whatever environment they would be thrust into.
And that folds into perfectly to what I want to discuss here, because as I was doing the show prep, one thing that came to mind immediately for me is when you look at the Marine Corps and their tradition is, nowadays we call it COIN, but small wars was a historical phrase you use. It has that tradition of doing counterinsurgency, to performing small wars, peace enforcement, if you want to look at it that perspective, but also kicking in the door during major conflicts. And when you look at what we've been doing for the last decade, really, the Brits and the Canadians, when they're thinking of the naval sense, they're talking about sea blindness, where the intellectual effort really is focused on the war we have right now. But as we both know, you have to keep a focus and find the right balance between the war you're fighting right now, what you need to be prepared to do materially, intellectually, philosophically, to be able to carry out that full range of missions that the Marines have really had a great expertise in, from that small war to the second half of our title here, forcible entry. When you look at the Marine Corps intellectual discussions that are going on right now outside of what we're doing in Afghanistan, do you see an effort being made to keep that balance both intellectually and as we're, the Marine Corps fired the first salvo before the QDR op when it comes to getting the material and equipment you need to keep that balance focus?
Yeah, I mean, and I'll tell you that striking that balance is not only hard, at times I wonder if it's in the too hard to do category. The reality is I think for any of the services, is you're going to excel. In whatever task that you're handed. So it's really hard to pick and choose the conflicts that you deploy off to, whether it's a small wars or an extended protracted counterinsurgency mission that you talked about, or these major conventional operations. So while the Marine Corps certainly has a tradition of this small wars, small wars manual type of involvement, it is punctuated every decade or two with World War II, a Korea, a Vietnam, Desert Storm. Certainly the opening salvo in Afghanistan was conventional going into Debrina and Kandahar, and certainly the opening salvo in Iraq was very conventional. So you've got a bifurcated effort there to maintain this focus on MEU-like deployments and engagements and small unit efforts and the small wars kinds of involvements, but you have to be ready for these big fights because you keep getting pulled into them, and you can't say no. I'm not going to go alongside the British Armored Division into southern into Kuwait and then into Afghanistan or Iraq or rather. So this trying to achieve a balance is extremely difficult because for an institution, and at the top level of the Marine Corps, it's just like the Army or the Air Force, you have to maintain an institutional focus in where do I invest my time and my efforts and my procurement dollars to equip my force to handle the mission that they've been called upon to do. And while I would like to go back to perhaps a small wars focus or this very expeditionary type living aboard ship and going where I'm needing to be called, the current fight is placing such huge demands on the cycling through of personnel and preparing for the types of missions that have been assigned the Corps that it's hard to step away from that. We've seen the rise of IEDs just as an example. And the response to that was the procurement of $20-plus billion worth of MRAPs. Well, you're not really in a position to say, no, I'm not going to get that if that kind of equipment is required to survive in that environment and get your guys safely from point A to point B. And yet, at the same time, I need procurement dollars to get the types of equipment that I want to stuff aboard an amphib and have it ready to do, some kind of amphibious op off of somebody's coast, and you can't tell me what coast I want to be off of. And the same way with training your personnel, either both in the schoolhouse or in your training and exercise curriculum, if I'm preparing to go to Afghanistan and my training regimen has me training in small villages and talking with village elders and handling these kinds of negotiations that I will find as I go from village to village, and conducting operations where the focus is on the people, creating a secure environment from the people and learning how to differentiate combatant from non-combatant and being very discriminatory in my use of firepower. That takes so many hours in the training day, and so then you don't have time to do things like a combined arms exercise, you know, where you're combining artillery fires and other indirect fires and, you know, armored vehicle movements and assaulting fortified positions and these kinds of things. You know, there's just not enough time in the training day. So everything that I'm hearing, talking with colleagues both in and out of the service, is this very difficult task in front of the Marine Corps leadership to balance the requirements of the now, you know, those demands being placed materially and in the training and education of your personnel and in the cycling through of these various mission sets, with what they know will more than likely happen perhaps a decade or two further on, where it will be much more of a conventional fight, and I don't have to be as discriminating in my use of fires, or I do have to get good again at combined arms operations. And they're really pressed for, you know, time and dollars in doing both of those. So, you know, my hat's off to them at trying to take up that challenge. And I think here in the next year or two, as our involvement in Afghanistan levels off, if not declines, and we start resetting the Marine Corps by replacing and repairing all the equipment that's really been, you know, ridden hard, we'll see if time is also freed up to shift focus from, you know, one set of skills to a different set of skills.
Eagle One.
Yeah, I had a chance to look at a writing you did about the for the long haul U.S. Marine Corps Fleet Marine Force for the 21st century.
Right.
And in there you discussed five things that the Marines should implement right now, starting with the develop and articulate a revised strategic concept and working through not replacing all the H-46s with Ospreys. Can you talk about those things? Are they still on your table as things the Marine Corps should be doing?
Yeah, again, this is the challenge of anybody, you know, analyzing the problems before the Marine Corps or the other services. And that is, on the one hand, institutionally, you have to at times wear a green eye shade and be counting, you know, beans, bullets, and bandages and the dollars that you have available to you. Because at that level, you have to be very in tune with Congress, with the national budget, not just the defense budget and the Marine Corps portion of that, but the whole national economic picture. And so I think things are getting ever more constrained and that the nation will have less flexibility in using its dollars, you know, servicing the national debt. We've seen the first wave of the baby boomers starting to retire and the beginning pressures on Social Security accounts and Medicare. I mean, you're all familiar with these kinds of issues. There is this issue of how many dollars will I have in future years, and how do I want to spend those dollars so that I get the biggest bang for the buck in an operational environment. And then you take off that hat and you put on your strategic, you know, vision hat, and I say, what does the world look like? What resources does the country have before it? It has an army and it has an Air Force and these others, and as well as a Marine Corps. And where might I be called upon to employ Marine Corps forces? And so when I balance those two views, again, going back to the program, where do I think Marine forces will be invested, and how do I want them equipped, understanding that if I commit down one path, I may not be able to culminate that path in getting the equipment that I would like to get. And we're seeing now issues with the F-35 program writ large, you know, a doubling of cost and the Nunn-McCurdy breach and all, spiraling costs of some of these other platforms. And so it's frustrating on the one hand to be counting dollars when you want to give the best equipment you have you can to your force, but from an institutional standpoint, I have to ensure that the force that I have is as best equipped as I can make it and have that be a sustainable investment over time that has the greatest utility across a range of operations. So some of the recommendations that came out of that paper were based on deck loading of amphibs, the types of missions that I would be performing across a range of operational environments, you know, how much of this really is littoral operations, how much of it is, you know, 1,000 miles from the coast, How do I get the biggest bang for my buck if I am conducting joint operations and I'm alongside Navy and Air Force and Army units? You know, all those things mixed together. And it seemed to us that when you took all those things, the Corps might be best served if it did retain a rotary wing fleet that incorporated something like an MH-60 helicopter as well as a set of MV-22s. And then you can also take that same argument and look at the F-35 Bravo. Does it make sense to have a split fleet on that as well? And we tried to acknowledge all the pros on one side as well as, you know, cons. Pros being the fewer type model series aircraft I have a larger single pool from which to draw from to service X number of units. I also have less to worry about in training and keeping current a set of pilots. You know, the more aircraft I have, the more kind of sub-career fields I have across that, and just makes personnel management issues a bit more difficult. But do I gain something on the operational end? And so once we had gone through that thought process, you see those recommendations that were in that paper.
I think the money challenge is something that we've referred to here, and it's over on my home blog. I call it the terrible 20s, because especially when you look a decade down the road, which is tomorrow, so much money is going to have to be invested in that decade, recapitalizing the strategic deterrent. If they keep that up, the Brits are going through that challenge early now for us. But where that money goes and what you buy with it, I think we've seen a trend where you look at the force of amphibious ships we have right now. We have a lot of large ships, carries a lot of material, a lot of Marines. And you have the Gallipoli challenge that we've always thought about since World War I. But you also combine that with the Atlantic conveyor challenge. And as potential competitors come online that have new and interesting sea denial systems, such as anti-ship ballistic missiles, and how that's going to proliferate over the next couple of decades, do you see that type of risk? Or really goes from an operational to a strategic risk of having those few ships with so much, like the Atlantic conveyor, that you're just one magic BB away from having to stop an operation?
Yeah, and you see this not only at the strategic level of how do I equip my Navy with these platforms, but even down to the tactical level of how do I employ my force once it's on land. And I think a great example of that would be the Expeditionary Fighting Vehicle. Is just a representative case. You know, I can fit a squad inside of an EFE, essentially. But if the EFE is hit, I've lost an entire squad. Yet if I use a vehicle, you know, roughly half that size and I can fit seven or eight guys in, now I've broken down squad integrity and I need two vehicles or more, you know, to get that same unit into the fight. And yet if I take a hit on one of those vehicles, I haven't lost the entire group of guys. I've just lost a subset of them. Similarly, if I lose an LHA or an LHD, just as you've said, you know, I've lost an extraordinary set of capabilities and rotary wing aircraft and whatever's in the well deck and, you know, a company plus of Marines aboard. And yet if I go with a smaller platform, let's say something, you know, twice the size of an LPD or what have you, I have decreased risk across the force by spreading that risk out. But I've increased the cost of the fleet. Because at the end of the day, I do have more ships that I have to build and I have to man, and then I've got, you know, a number of set of engines that I'm having to run, so my, you know, cost of diesel fuel, et cetera, goes up as well. And so it really does take a lot of time and effort, and I think something that's been lacking is a lot of experimentation before committing to a single high-profile, limited-buy program. And find out what sorts of combinations optimize an objective given all the factors that you have to take into account. So I think that there's a couple of things that we've been missing over the last several years. It's this willingness to do a lot of robust experimentation and try, you know, testing things. We did a lot of testing with the Calibra series of experiments before we actually came up with a workable solution to the Gallipoli problem, right? And then being willing to invest in a term that Andrew Krepinevich has used is wildcatting, where I buy a limited set of platforms and see what I can do with those before I commit to a single purchase on a given class and invest everything into that. And then I think the really kind of a tangential issue you raised on the amphib fleet is not real good working relationships between the Marine Corps and the Navy and really arguing successfully for a robust amphibious capability. So I think we've really missed the dot on that. And it's now on number of 33 ships, 11 of each type, is far short of what the nation really needs if you want a credible amphibious capability.
Absolutely. One thing that folds into that as well is if you're going to be forced to have that few number of ships, and the further you get away from having to do a non-permissive environment, as some people like to call it, forcible entry, a little more aggressive phrase, is you really don't know. It's a little fuzzy because you don't have recent experience. Like an infantry company nowadays has lots of recent experience to pull off of, whether in Iraq, Afghanistan, or elsewhere. But you need some flexibility there. So when you're picking your platforms, I hear a lot of argument going that we don't need a wet well deck, or we do need a wet well deck type of ship. If you need that flexibility in order to enable experimentation and also to give you the ability in the future of going, hey, what we thought isn't exactly right, we need to be able to do this, where do you get your better bang for the buck if you're talking about a wet well deck or not?
Yeah, I think it's maximizing options. I mean, if you take wet well deck and you replace that with forcible entry, if I don't want to invest in a forcible entry capability, the ability to push combat power ashore into an area that somebody doesn't want me to be, right, then all I'm left with is flying into a fixed airfield, sailing into a deep water port, or driving there on a very well-known and mapped network of roads from contiguous land space. And we wouldn't want to self-constrain by taking out, that amphibious option. And so I think there's an argument there for an ability to have a credible combat force afloat able to conduct credible amphibious operations. So now come back to the wet well deck issue. If I don't have the ability to put vehicles and heavy equipment and supplies into a ship-to-shore connector and sail that thing to a beach somewhere, then I'm restricted to flying weather and only those things that I can move by air. So when I send out a platform with Marines and combat power, if it is limited to flight deck only operations, then I have self-constrained, my set of options to only those operations that I can conduct in flyable weather, if that makes sense. So I think having a well deck-like capability, and we really haven't gotten into the MLP and maybe craning stuff from a ship to a ship-to-shore connector, but I think that well deck type of capability gives you these options of day or night, good weather or bad. I can still put power ashore and I can still pull stuff off if I'm really pushed up against it.
Eagle One.
Well, you've led right into my question, which has to do with sea basing. Is sea basing a viable concept in the world of anti-ship missiles that can seem to be launched from almost any platform that floats in a lot of places ashore? And what's the future of that if it is viable?
Yeah, I think, a sea base is going to have three different types of threats. One is undersea. That's why we have submarines to, protect that kind of capability. One is surface, and it's getting to the point with surface ship capabilities and naval strike aircraft that you're able to keep a competitor surface fleet at a pretty good distance. So I think that's not as viable a threat as it was in years past. And then you have the threat of long-range precision strike systems like an anti-ship ballistic missile or a long-range anti-ship cruise missile. And those are getting nastier as they get into the supersonic variety and they can punch out 200, 250 miles. But even with those threats against the sea base, I would say that, number one, a sea base is able to move. So, again, if you don't have this capability, then you're operating from a fixed basing structure that doesn't go anywhere. I can easily target it with known GPS coordinates and a number of other factors. I can cut it off from communications, and I can barrage the thing with ballistic missiles. Now, with a fixed land base, you do have some resiliency in that, you know, the land mass itself can absorb a heck of a lot of hits, and I can shelter things in, you know, deeply buried shelters or hardened shelters, and I have some capability to repair, you know, an airfield or a port, realizing that the enemy has a limited magazine of things that he can throw against me. But again, having this ability to have a basing infrastructure just about anywhere in the world I want to, and the fact that it's mobile, you can mitigate the types of threats that are posed to such a sea base to, I think, an acceptable level. And it does give you this additional option that no other country in the world has. So I think it is something that we need to continue to pursue. I wish it were more robust than, you know, the Navy and the Department of Defense appears to be willing to invest in. But, you know, we need to make best use of those capabilities that we'll have over the next couple of decades.
In the ground combat we've seen in the last decade, one thing that has become more and more important and has a smaller and smaller error, probability of error, so to speak, is precision fires. And I think we saw in Israel's actions in the Gaza recently, and also a little bit of, about Hezbollah, we saw the importance of precision fires from the sea, but also the challenge when you saw their Corvette get hit by that anti-ship cruise missile, basically launched out of somebody's garage on the coast, where things are a lot different now than they used to be. It's not a wide open beach with a couple of farmhouses. It's not some coral atoll just located with military people. There's a lot of the places that we need to be prepared to go near shore are urban, suburban, heavily populated, and with the CNN effect, you don't have a tolerance for the collateral damage you used to be. So being able to do that precision fires close to shore is as important as we found in theater in Iraq and Afghanistan. Do you see moves being made by the Navy to support the Marines from both sea-based and air-based platforms to be able to provide the amount of direct fire support that they need without doing the collateral damage that's going to give the higher commanders a lot of headaches?
Yeah, I think with air in support of ground, very good. I think naval surface fires, it's very poor. You know, since we've gone away from the old battleships, you look at the number of either vertical launch cells that are on a given Navy platform or the guns that are able to fire at a given range, and it's much limited. Bob Warwick, currently the undersecretary, has done some great analysis, and on the one hand, you can say that given the number of cells we have to bring to bear, we've got more aggregate firepower than at any time in the past. But then you go to the dollar issue, and it's how much do each one of those shots cost, and what is my ability to resupply at sea with those kinds of weapons capabilities? So the ranges that we seem to be operating at, the range that ships have to now hold off the coast because of the ASCM threat that you've already mentioned, and the cost per shot do become an issue. You know, on the one hand, you can say, look, money's no object if our guys are in the thick of it, and yet we've seen war after war after war over history that at some point the cost does become a factor in the ability of a nation to prosecute war over time. As far as the risk tolerance of, you know, being willing to throw guys into battle and having to discriminate using precision fires between targets, that's really a matter of the type of war that you're fighting, what stakes are in play, and what your objective is in being involved in this war to begin with. So if it very much is a counterinsurgency, irregular warfare environment, where collateral damage is a real problem, you know, the CNN effect and all these things, you know, what the Israelis were having to do both in southern Lebanon and then in the Gaza Strip later on, discrimination and the importance of precision fire is very, very important. If you're talking an all-out conventional war, and the objectives to be obtained in that kind of warfare, collateral damage becomes just a feature of the landscape. And I think that ability to tolerate the imprecision of fires, especially when you look at cost per shot, your willingness to tolerate that kind of stuff, goes up. So it is a relative measure of the types of battle that you're involved in. The issue that you talked about the ability to range at greater distances with precision fires, especially as we see the proliferation of technology across a broader set of actors. If I'm a Hezbollah-like entity and I can use longer range anti-tank guided missiles, again, when you look at my ability to buy those things versus what an industrial power has to spend to field the kind of tank that a modern ATGM can take out, you do start to see a cost-imposing strategy playing out on the battlefield. And we have not yet figured out whether we would be able to sustain the kinds of operations that we prefer to conduct in the face of an opponent that is armed with relatively lower cost but extremely capable and lethal precision fires that he can range at increasing distances. So I think this is an area that is really ripe for further experimentation and exploration. And I think that where it will lead us is to realize that we are once again entering, more than likely, an age where attrition has to be part of our accounting for correlation of forces and the costs that will be paid in future environments, especially, as you had indicated, if we start getting more and more into urban environments. So when you then go back and you look at how I'm outfitting the force, the size of the force that I have to use, especially when we're talking an all-volunteer military where each individual soldier, sailor, airman, or marine is very, very expensive in salary and medical benefits and families and those kinds of things. And then the types of platforms that we're buying. We had to cut the cost or cut the number of EFEs in half. You're seeing a doubling of costs in the F-35 program, et cetera. How many of these things can you lose in a high attrition environment because the enemy is equipped with precision strike capabilities, and how long can you sustain those losses and replace them over the course of a war? And of course, we aren't in that right now. I think it's coming, but it'll be anybody's guess as to how well we will fare in that kind of an environment.
And I think you brought up a topic right there, which is a great way of making a lot of people very uncomfortable. When you talk about attrition and you talk about sustainment and build quantity as a quality all of its own, if you're only got a few dozen smart little missiles to play out and all of a sudden you find out you need to be here more than just a couple of weeks, it becomes a problem. Well, Dakota, I'll tell you what, this has been a very fast half hour. I wanted to take the opportunity on behalf of myself and Eagle One and our listeners to thank you for coming on a guest for today. I think we could easily have once again gone for another hour.
Well, I appreciate it. It's been a real pleasure for me, and I hope it was of value to your listeners and folks here on the website, and look forward to our next opportunity.
Absolutely. I think it would be great to have you again, and have a good week, Dakota. Thanks again.
Thanks.
This is a quick reminder to everybody. If you've come in late, you're listening to Navy Mil Blog Radio Midrats. I'm Sal from Commander Salamander with my co-host Eagle One from Eagle Speak. Our next guest is Mark E. Stenovich. He was commissioned in a Marine through the Naval ROTC program. He's also has a background as a field artillery officer. He served in all four Marine divisions, including as a battery executive officer, battery commander, artillery battalion, fire support director, F3 operations, XO, and also fire support coordinator for the 25th Marine. In his civilian life, he works in preparedness for Vermont's military, Vermont's hospitals, developing emergency operation plans and training program. And as you'll soon be able to tell, Mark was born in Massachusetts, where he graduated also from Holy Cross in 1986 with a BA in history. And Mark, welcome to Midrats.
Hi, thank you, Finn. It's great to be here this afternoon. Colonel Wood made a lot of very, very great points about the tug of war between the war we're fighting and the war we might fight. I think that he hit a number of things very squarely. To sort of boil it down, I think in the age of industrial warfare, particularly as weapon system costs rise, and this is, you know, decades old, war, when it comes, is always sort of a head-on collision in between what budgetary projections were and what, you know, strategic combat realities are. And the force that does the best is the one that makes that the softest collision. I want to bring it down a little bit to the tactical level of forcible entry with a couple of comments. One is, you had mentioned the Gallipoli effect. I think it is, we could call it today the Iwo Jima effect. There is sometimes a perception out there that the Marine Corps goes around looking for fortified beachheads to try and kick in. We are prepared to kick down the door if necessary, but we would prefer, frankly, if we found places where the door was pretty much unlocked. For every Iwo Jima in Tawa, we have any number of amphibious landings across the Pacific that were either unopposed completely, such as Okinawa, or relatively unopposed, such as MacArthur's landings on the coast of New Guinea. I think that still holds true today. Haiti's a good example. It is an axiom of faith that you cannot count on having a secure port or airfield facility capable of handling any kind of flow of forces ashore if you are really and truly looking to interpose yourself in a place where somebody else might not want you. What we have seen here in the last couple of decades, and General Hagee, the Commandant of the Marine Corps before General Conway, and now General Conway have commented in the negative on this, is a decline in the capability of projection of power ashore. And that projection of power ashore can either be an opposed landing, an amphibious assault, what we're calling forcible entry, or really any other kind of power ashore. And what I mean by a loss of capability is the components that have to go into putting those boots in the sand, the ability to have landing support beyond the amphibs themselves, what had been the attack transports, the supply vessels that are out there, and even the amphibs themselves. At this point, depending on how you do the math, we can either put 1.6 or 1.8 MEBs ashore. And we talk in terms of operational maneuver from the sea. Frankly, with under 10,000 trigger pullers going ashore as our maximum capability at this point, we're really looking at tactical maneuver that may have some operational implications. That is a situation that I think Lieutenant Colonel Wood described very well. We have to, in this day of fiscal austerity, take a look at what capabilities we want to maintain. Now, the capabilities that we're really talking about, if you read through the QDR, there is quite a bit of mention about projection of power projection. I would submit that without the ability to project power ashore, forcibly if necessary, you limit your power projection realities to a very small number of viable choices. And that's something I think that we have seen the Marine Corps' commandants of the past and now General Conway himself look about very nervously at. It was General Conway who warned us, much as Colonel Wood had stated, that not every war is going to look like Iraq and Afghanistan. The ability to put substantial combat power ashore and execute follow-on operations is something that we desperately need. If we're going to put any kind of meaningful power ashore, it's coming across the water. That has been the way now for quite some time, and I think it's going to continue to be that way for the foreseeable future.
And Eagle One, do you have a question for Mark?
Oh, sure. Given the amount of time it takes to build up a force, I mean, during Desert Storm, we spent, 3-4 months 5 months getting ready to invade Iraq. Why is the Marine Corps a viable kick in the door? Hold it for, 2 weeks, whatever MEU is supposed to hold it for, till we get the follow-on force, if it takes that long to get everybody ready to sustain a force in the field?
Well, I think what we want to be able to look at is more than just a MEU. A Marine Expeditionary Unit built around a battalion landing team is a surprisingly small number of folks. I think what we're really talking about here is a forcible entry on a scale somewhat larger than that. If we have to make such a deployment, we don't necessarily have the choice of where it is that we're going to go, with the exception of the vicinity of the enemy we're fighting. If it means we have to come across a beach, we need to be able to do that efficiently and effectively, so that we can put combat power ashore rapidly, build up that combat power ashore, and be able to execute operations quickly. There is a tremendous amount of value in having the ability to use the waters of the world as maneuver space. And that is not necessarily something that flying in echelons of combat power allow you to do. Several of the war games that we have conducted at the strategic level of late have emphasized the difficulty, without the ability to go in via the water, of building up combat power in any kind of meaningful way in a timeline that would be required for the kind of operations that we're conducting. So I think it is still the means of getting where you need to go the fastest with the mostest.
Well, Mark, I want to
I got a follow on. I should let you know that. Isn't the purpose of the MEU, if that's still the right terminology, we have six or nine of them now, seven of them.
Right.
Isn't that to go and do that mission of, you know, we got an emergency, we're going to go deal with it in 15 days, and they carry everything that they need to do that for that period of time. And the question then is, what do we use for a follow-on force that can deploy quickly enough and sustain itself in the field if we really have that kind of emergency? And how do we get that stuff ashore? Judging by Haiti, it takes forever to get our allegedly JLOTS material across the beach.
Well, you hit on a good point, Eagle. JLOTS is interesting from a couple of different angles. When we're talking about building and testing and having some flexibility to test, JLOTS has a lot of good things going for it. The design of the vessels themselves, the capability of rolling ashore quickly are very desirable features to have. A couple of drawbacks to JLOTS, though. It's a transportation command asset. It's essentially a national asset that gets parsed to the combatant commander. And what is going on in Haiti with JLOTS is not truly supporting an amphibious operation. It's supporting operations ashore, in this case, humanitarian operations. But JLOTS, nor MSC, by the way, are truly built to support landing operations. What we should probably be taking a look at is to have similar capabilities of vessels of that type, or at least with some of those features, be part of an active duty Navy force that would be a part of an amphibious force, an amphibious task force, where the amphibious load plan of those vessels has been dictated by the landing force commander based on what their estimate of combat operations ashore would need to be. I could see vessels of that type, and I don't know, Feb, you correct me if I'm wrong, are about 20,000 tons, you know, anywhere between 20 and 22 knots. They've got the ability to de facto be a much more efficient replacement for what we used to have as the attack transports and the supply ships that would be the auxiliaries that would go in an amphibious force. I think something like that would be a certainly an interesting option to look at. A follow-on force, Eagle, is the 1st or 2nd Marine Division or the 3rd Marine Division that would be embarked out of, you know, Pendleton or Lejeune or Okinawa, respectively, to go in ashore behind the MEU if it was was a situation where the Muse simply wasn't big enough, then it would be a much larger amphibious force put together for the initial entry. Something like you saw with in 1991 with the 4th MEBS amphibious demonstration off of the Iraqi coast. I think it would have to be along that nature. Mu is not necessarily a massive force of power projection. In many cases, it is almost a power presence force rather than a true power projection influence force. So that's it's sort of answering the question by asking another one: is why would not we have a larger amphibious capability to follow on to or entry in the place of the Marine Expeditionary Unit?
Hey Mark, I wanted to bring us back to something we talked about at the tail end with Dakota, and that involved the ability to be able to sustain operations and to sustain support for Marines ashore. Now, when I look back at the invasion of Iraq, one of my favorite moments there at the very beginning was what was called in the Commonwealth Five-Inch Friday, where you had up on the Alfaw Peninsula, you had a bunch of frigates go up there with their five-inch guns, mostly I think they were all Commonwealth frigates, and did the good Lord's work with the five-inch gun. And you see a lot of our allies are continuing on and will prefer to get the 127-millimeter five-inch gun, whatever you want to call it, on those ships that they have the ability to, really with the exception of the Germans that really like the 76-millimeter. But when I look at LCS, I just ignore the 57-millimeter, but we'll be lucky if we get three blocks of the non-line-of-sight missile, which gives you basically 45 of those on an LCS. And I think the whole concept of being able to do reloads, et cetera, and so forth. As a Marine, look at the very fundamental but very critical ability to be able to look over your shoulder past the brake line and see ships out there that can give you the support. We hear from the Marines now and then about the concern. Has it gotten to the point that they're just tired of complaining about it, or do you see any movement to try to reemphasize the fact that that's just not answering the mail?
I'm not sure Marines are good at that. I'm not sure we've ever stopped complaining. We have, I think, gotten the impression that some of this has fallen perhaps a little bit on deaf ears, and that we have some fairly, I don't want to say unrealistic, but certainly optimistic understand or beliefs in rockets, VLS, as naval surface fire support capabilities. I'm also wondering if with the collapse of some of our ancillary capabilities in support of amphibious operations, if this is not a signal that the United States Navy has drifted away from the Marine Corps in their understanding of the need for power projection across a beach. You hit what is obviously a very big issue with the Marine Corps, and that is the ability to have fire support ashore, in part because of a lot of what was identified by Colonel Wood in the previous discussion, which is the lethality of even a small number of weapon systems, at least with a first-shot capability, and their ability to take out what in our current force structure are extremely low density, extremely high value targets. The naval surface fire support provided by missiles in such an environment, I think, is going to be one heck of a drain on the cash register. As you well know, I have advocated for a precision course correction fuse type of development for a larger, much larger than 127-millimeter naval gun projectile, something like that could be an affordable, both a ship killer and an amphibious support cannon, certainly has its place to be considered among all those other super expensive weapon systems that, quite frankly, could be perhaps more effectively replaced by something of much lower cost, much higher density, much more flexible in its delivery, much easier to resupply. There's a lot of advantages to having a naval gun that has got the ability for precision or semi-precision fires ahead of something like the Mark 41. The Marine Corps is continuing to push for that. It is always a source of discussion when the discussion turns to our amphibious capabilities. I'm not sure how much traction it has gotten. It has certainly been something that has been on the mind in the words of General Conway and General Hagee before him. I would be interested to hear from somebody at a little bit higher level of the United States Navy about what their druthers are or how much interest they have in the development of such a system.
I remember seeing an interview once with a American Army infantryman when he was talking about he fought from Normandy through Battle of the Bulge and into the occupation of Germany. And he said, yeah, 88 millimeters woke him up. 155, they kind of worried him a bit. An 8-inch naval gun made him dig a little bit deeper, and a battleship gun scared the crap out of him. There is a thing to be said with size and a variety of reasons. Eagle One, you have a question?
Well, actually, it's a question that Claude Barrabee posed some time ago about naval gunfire, and what Claude asked was, with the rapidity with which the Marines have advanced, don't they outpace the gunfire from the ships? I assume he means that they're not going to sit on the beach and stay within the range of a 5-inch or 6-inch or whatever type of gun.
Well, that's part of the issue, Eagle, is that the 127 millimeter gun, even in its most exotic form with the latest in propellant and projectile developments, probably doesn't have the range to be a truly optimal fire support piece for the Marines ashore. We don't intend to hang around on the beach unless that's where the mission is. The vessels themselves having to have fire support areas or fire support stations well within the range of anti-ship cruise missiles or any other kind of anti-ship weapons is not terribly desirable either. It has been discussed before, a modern design for a projectile that's more ballistically efficient with modern propellants and a course correction fuse type of design may have some potential for the 80 to 100 kilometer range. And now what you're really talking about is a weapon system that can support support Marines ashore for a goodly bit of the range fan. I think we definitely need to look at that. The projectiles the Navy has last fired are at the absolute bottom of the technical potential for ballistic efficiency. The propellants that we're using are, many, many decades old. There is more, there is better, there is far more efficient out there. The lack of interest in it, quite frankly, and I saw this on the ground side of the artillery as well, from the United States' standpoint in the last 30 years, has been rather flabbergasting. And everybody knows who Jerry Bull was, the designer of the super gun that I think the Mossad took care of in Paris some years ago. A good deal of what his research was extending the ballistic potential of an artillery piece, and it's also very applicable to that of naval gunfire. The fact that we haven't and have decided that we are going to do so instead with a much more expensive option of the VLS and weapon systems like that has been a disappointment to the Marine Corps, because in some cases there is no substitute for volume fire, plain and simple.
Hey Mark, as we're coming into the 5-minute prior mark, I want to throw this little question for you that kind of goes back to the beginning conversation we had with Dakota earlier this hour. When we look at what the Marines are doing in Afghanistan right now, and I think the guys that came up with the idea of keeping the Army mostly to the east and the Marines mostly to the south, I think deserve a few beers. I think those capabilities, that was the right way to mix them up, so to speak. But when the Afghan operation eventually comes to a close, what do you think the Marine Corps should remember or hoist on board going forward from a lessons learned point of view? But I think what's even more important, when they're done with Afghanistan, because of the uniqueness of that environment, what do they probably need to forget?
Well, that is the obviously the $64,000 question. I'll sort of tell you a story before I play that one. The new counterinsurgency manual, I don't know if anybody's had a chance to read it, has an introduction by Sarah Sewell in there. And I was very disappointed to read that introduction because she was mentioning that because of our experiences in Vietnam, the Army and the Marine Corps didn't want to have anything to do with low-intensity conflict. And I could tell her, since I had served since the mid-80s, that that is patently wrong. There was plenty of interest in things like MUDWA, or what we call MUDWA, low-intensity, medium-intensity conflict. There simply wasn't the money and the opportunity for training in it. You know, some of the more fundamental lessons I think we need to take away from it, and it's much more relearning than learning. I think the Afghanistan situation and the Iraq situation would have been very familiar to people like Herman Hannikin and Chesty Puller, who did such things in Santo Domingo and Haiti. The lessons we take away, understanding the human terrain as well as the physical terrain, understanding sensitivity to culture, understanding a lack of understanding of culture. They're not going to give us all of our cultural lessons learned. They understand that there's an advantage to having a fairly anonymous culture. Things to forget. Things to forget would be things like warfare, not including a tremendous advantage in having the preponderance of timely and accurate fires. Calling warfare what essentially has been termed by some to be lawfare. There is a high-intensity end of warfare that we must be ready for. And these are conversations that have been had in the Marine Corps at all levels. If you lose Afghanistan, it would be a detrimental effect to U.S. interests in the long term, certainly, but maybe even in the short term. However, to lose a high-intensity conflict against an adversary that can bring even moderately equal combat power against you in a time and place is immediate and catastrophic to the United States and our interests worldwide. So if I had to, those would be the two, those are it.
Eagle One, we got time for about one more minute for a quick question for Mark before we have to sign off.
Well, someone has posed a pretty good question. Actually, I think it's Lee C. How much of the op-tempo of the ARG is focused on OMFT, forcible entry, and how much for other missions?
That's another very large question. I'm not sure we have got the ability and the money to do as much of the operational maneuver from the sea training as we would like to have. The real-world experiences that we can get in the different places around the world where MUs go ashore with a startling rapidity is very valuable to us because we don't have enough of the OMFT training. The business end of it, the combat end of operational maneuver, we don't have a whole bunch of experience at all. So we have been doing a lot of things other than operational maneuver with a sharp focus. So that's a very good question. We need more of the operational maneuver.
And Mark, as we're coming up near the bottom of the hour, I just wanted to take a chance and say thank you for coming on board to writing off our hours on the Marine Corps Enforceable Entry. I think if nothing else, this has told us that we need to have another episode on the Marine Corps and balance the Navy discussions a little more. In 10 seconds, though, let me ask you this question. Are you happy with the miniseries The Pacific so far?
I, believe it or not, have not seen it yet at all, but I am dying to. If it is the equivalent of a Band of Brothers, it will be something I will see 100 times.
Well, consider yourself counseled because it's excellent. And they had me when they walked ashore in Guadalcanal. They had the 1903 bolt action rifle, so they're accurate. Thank you very much. And for all the listeners, I wanted to ask you to please join us next week for episode 14. Our topic is going to be multilateralism at sea. We're going to have as our guest Henda Vriet. He's a Netherlands correspondent for James Defense Weekly and security and defense specialist at Radio Netherlands, along with James S. Robbins, the senior editorial writer for Foreign Affairs at the Washington Times, and what would be probably familiar to most of you, the author of Last in Their Class, Custer, Pickett, and the Goats of West Point. Hope everybody has a great Navy Marine Corps day.
Brandon.